welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Immunology. In this podcast, three experts consider aspects that are crucial to improving outcomes in patients with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, the significance of disease burden when assessing patients, the importance of timely diagnosis and early treatment, and the potential of emerging treatment options. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Bristol Myers Squibb. In this first interview, Professor Hart discusses the significant burden that ulcerative colitis places on patients both clinically and psychosocially, which should be proactively managed as part of a patient-centered care approach to improve overall quality of life.
We know that ulcerative colitis is a chronic, relapsing and remitting inflammatory disorder, and as the name suggests, it represents inflammation predominantly affecting the colon. Because inflammation affects the colon, the symptoms patients mainly experience is diarrhea, often with blood, and cramps at any time, but particularly before the patient needs to evacuate the bowel. Urgency or the need to dash the toilet is another key symptom patients experience. Indeed, the scoring systems used in clinical trials and indeed in clinical practice for ulcerative colitis include the Mayo score and the patient-reported outcome, or PRO2, and these scoring systems include stool frequency and rectal bleeding. But we also need to remember that these patients experience many other extra-intestinal manifestations. Indeed, 50% of patients with IBD will experience extra-intestinal manifestations. These can include skin problems such as pyoderma gangrenosum or erythema nodosum, joint manifestations such as arthralgia or arthritis, eye manifestations such as iritis and uveitis, liver manifestations such as primary sclerosing cholangitis, and also venous thromboembolism. However, patients with ulcerative colitis also experience a multitude of other symptoms, and these symptoms and impacts of their disease can occur not only while their inflammatory disease is flaring, but also while the disease is in remission. And these symptoms include fatigue, pain, and often continence worries for patients. Indeed, approximately 60% of patients with IBD report chronic pain for more than 5 years, and there can often be a dissociation with pain with indices of inflammation. Approximately 40% of patients with IBD will report fatigue, even when the disease is in remission, and this can be the major symptom which impacts and limits their life. Maybe unpredictability is the key hallmark of this condition. That's unpredictability in not knowing day to day if they will have to dash the toilet or worry about not making it in time. Unpredictability not knowing when the disease will potentially flare and impact on a significant life event. And unpredictability in not knowing whether they will develop colorectal cancer or indeed if their children will develop the disease. Now, all of this uncertainty or unpredictability carries with it a big psychological morbidity. And I think it's quite obvious that anxiety or depression again goes hand in hand with these conditions. Indeed, depression occurs in around 25% of patients, most commonly in the first year after diagnosis, when the patient is trying to get to grips with having a chronic lifelong condition. Less is known about anxiety, but generalized anxiety is thought to occur in around 30% of patients. Indeed, patients can also have issues with sexual dysfunction, body image, and disordered eating. Many of the symptoms that patients experience, and really importantly, it shows us that we as clinicians consistently underestimate the overall impact these symptoms have on the patient's quality of life. Well, we simply need to ask our patients about these symptoms in our day-to-day consultations. There can be a don't ask, don't tell culture, particularly about difficult or perceived non-related, such as joint or skin issues, or embarrassing topics such as sexual dysfunction or continence issues. So find your own words that can be used in your day-to-day consultations. For example, at the beginning of any consultation, you could simply ask, what's on your agenda today? What do you want to talk about today? To make sure we're covering everything that's important to that patient on that day. Or how are things generally going for you? Or I appreciate that having this condition can impact on all aspects of life. How is it impacting on yours? Now, there are scales for some of these symptoms, some of which are used in clinical trials, less frequently used in clinical practice. Some include the patient-reported outcome measurement, information system or PROMIS, fatigue score or pain score. But it can be just as effective to ask a patient on a scale of 0 to 10 For example, if 10 is the worst pain experience and 0 the most reasonable or lowest pain level, for the patient to gauge where they are on that sort of scale. For depression, the patient health questionnaire 9 is often used, and for anxiety, the GAD-7 scale is often used. But I think in addition to asking these questions about the negative impacts, it's also important to try and promote positive psychology and encourage emotional well-being for the patients by developing resilience, self-efficacy and self-confidence for patients with a chronic disease like this. When we think about treating inflammatory bowel disease, we need to think about treating two major aspects. One is the inflammation. So if inflammation is the target, this needs to be tackled with all the drugs we have available to the best of their ability by assessing and monitoring and using, for example, objective measures like fecal calprotectin, endoscopy, histology or radiology. But if those that is treated adequately and the patient still has residual symptoms such as pain or fatigue or psychological issues, those issues also need to be noted and then addressed in an appropriate way. Simply acknowledging these more difficult symptoms can be very important to patients and is very important for the clinician and patient relationship. Sometimes these psychological issues need integrating with primary care, the GP, or indeed community psychology. Sometimes units can have more sophisticated links with psychological service or access to pain clinics, which can be very helpful for these patients. One study to note is the IBD Boost study being conducted in the UK by Professor Christine Norton. This is a randomised controlled trial which is looking at trying to address these more difficult symptoms of, for example, pain and fatigue by randomising patients to either care as usual or to an intervention, which is very much a psychological approach to trying to help patients with these symptoms. It's also important to recognise the burden of current treatment options for patients. This can be the side effects of treatments, the need to have time off work, or the cost for hospital visits, for investigations or infusions. And also, of course, the major concerns or fears that patients can have, particularly about surgery for ulcerative colitis patients. One way to obviate this is to have joint consultations where, for example, the physician and the surgeon can be present in the room at the same time as the patient and can really work through pros and cons of trying another medical therapy or potentially going to surgery and really helping the patient understand what surgery may mean for them. Thanks very much indeed for your attention.
Thank you for your valuable insights, Professor Hart. Now let's move on to our next interview with Dr. Malmed. He is going to discuss why a timely diagnosis and early treatment in ulcerative colitis is so important, including the potentially progressive nature of the disease, prognostic risk factors, current treatments for moderate to severe versus mild ulcerative colitis, and therapeutic drug monitoring as a useful approach for optimal management.
There are many similarities between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Both represent a spectrum of inflammatory bowel disease. There's many genes that overlap between the two as far as etiopathogenesis. And we believe that there is also structural similarity between the two conditions such that we can learn from one to the other, although the two are somewhat distinct. In Crohn's disease, we have understood and learned that there is a progression in a majority of patients, probably related to the development of fibrosis and bowel damage that occurs over time in patients who are untreated or undertreated. And those complications eventually result in fibrosis, narrowing, stricturing, perforating disease that may require surgery to address those complications. For ulcerative colitis, the story may be similar but somewhat different. What we've seen in ulcerative colitis is that there is a subset of patients that do have significant bowel damage that develops over time in association with disease and probably correlating with the severity of the disease. We have patients that have mucosal changes that eventually result in fibrosis, perhaps foreshortening of the colon, a tubular-looking colon with loss of Hoekstra, and that may also result in eventual stricturing, possibly even associated with the development of dysplasia and cancer. And so the idea is behind these inflammatory bowel diseases is that before we see the development of these and the progression of these complications, that we have a window of intervention where the disease is primarily inflammatory before fibrosis has set in, where we have the optimal time to intervene and change that course, change that natural history trajectory such that we're not moving towards progression of the disease toward a complication that may require surgery, but rather to stave that off and leave the disease as uncomplicated and therefore treated medically. In addition to the progression from the severity standpoint, we've also learned from epidemiologic studies that patients with ulcerative colitis can have a change in the extent of inflammation over time as well, such that patients with initially limited disease, such as proctitis or proctosigmoiditis, may have progression to more extensive involvement and even pancolitis in up to 50% of patients. So does treatment actually alter that natural history? We're not totally sure of that with evidence, but it certainly stands based on the evidence to date that mucosal healing is associated with a less likely future risk of surgery, less likely future risk of significant symptoms, that early treatment of patients with more limited disease may actually be also associated with a lower risk of progression to more extensive disease. The main diagnostic tool for ulcerative colitis is a colonoscopy, and we can learn an enormous amount of the disease risk and probably future likelihood of progression just based on colonoscopy. We can understand the disease extent, and the disease extent may be associated with future risk. We can understand the severity of inflammation and specifically the characterization of ulcers and ulcer depth, deep ulcers. Are probably the worst prognostic factor that we've identified within patients with ulcerative colitis, and again, also identifiable on colonoscopy. So early referral for gastroenterology evaluation with colonoscopy is probably the most important thing that we can do to identify patients at risk. But there are also other features that that have been identified that can help us understand what somebody's future risk of progression is. And that future risk of progression, the future risk of complication that may require surgery, essentially refractory disease, there are several of them. So a family history of inflammatory bowel disease, particularly family history of more complicated disease that requires surgery, family history of other family members who have had ulcerative colitis and progressed to colectomy can also portend a worse prognosis. Younger age of diagnosis has been associated with worse complication. And when it comes to understanding and assessing the severity of the disease, also several factors in addition to colonoscopy that typically will correlate with colonoscopy and colonoscopic findings, and those will include serum markers of inflammation, particularly a C-reactive protein, and also fecal biomarkers, such as a fecal calprotectin or fecal lactoferrin can also be used to understand the severity of disease. There's been associations on an environmental level with the onset of ulcerative colitis. For example, the cessation of cigarette smoking has been associated with onset of ulcerative colitis, but there may be other environmental factors associated with severe disease, although these play a more minor role really in understanding how we're going to treat this patient going forward. But again, I want to come back to those clinical features of understanding the severity of inflammation at the time of colonoscopy, and particularly having deep ulcers as an indicative of somebody who's more likely to progress. And these are individuals who really need to be treated properly and appropriately upfront with effective therapy as early as possible in order to minimize the risk of progression of those deep ulcers, which could result in progression to more refractory and complicated disease requiring colectomy. Well, the treatment of mild or mild to moderate ulcerative colitis is quite different from the treatment of more moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. And the primary mainstay of therapy in patients with milder disease is the 5-ASA, the 5-aminosalicylates, or mesalamine, or mesalamine-related medications. And this is in contrast to Crohn's disease, where we don't really have that effective and a topical option for long-term therapy that we do in ulcerative colitis. These 5-ASAs, or mesalamine compounds, are quite effective in patients with mild to moderate disease, both orally and topically. And so studies have demonstrated that both the combination of oral with topical treatment, particularly in patients with more limited proctitis or proctosigmoiditis or left-sided ulcerative colitis, but also in patients with more extensive involvement, is more effective than treatment with oral alone or treatment with topical alone. And that treatment with both oral and topical 5-ASAs or mesalamine products is again effective for patients with mild to moderate disease. In contrast, patients with more moderate to severe disease do need systemic therapy in order to really get control of overactive inflammation in the gut, in the colon. And those therapies, there's a number of them now that are available and recommended in our various international guidelines. Initially, the biologic class with initial anti-TNF drugs such as infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab. There are now anti-IL-12, IL-23 agents such as ustekinumab and possibly new therapies on the horizon in that class. We also have anti-integrin therapy with vedolizumab. And we also have two oral small molecule treatments now. We have tofacitinib, a JAK inhibitor, and ozanimod, an S1P inhibitor. And so we now have a number of different options for treatment. The challenge becomes not what are the treatment options available, but which treatment options should we use in a particular patient? What order should we use them in? How do we position one therapy against another? And there's an emerging body of evidence that is helping to guide us. At this point right now, guidelines generally recommend any of these medications for initial treatment, although regulatory agencies have given us a sense of what agents might be placed in front of another, such as tofacitinib being used for treatment after failure of an anti-TNF therapy, at least in the United States, based on safety profiles. So more to come in this space as far as positioning, but certainly differences in how we would approach treatment for mild relative to more moderate to severe disease. So when it comes to improving outcomes, there's a number of factors at play, and we've discussed that there's several therapies that are available that are highly effective for patients with ulcerative colitis, both in the mild end of the spectrum and the more moderate to severe end of the spectrum. But when it comes to improving outcomes, it's not just what therapies we use, but how we use those therapies, and understanding that there are ways that we can now optimize the therapies that we use using a number of different approaches. One approach to optimizing therapy relates to therapeutic drug monitoring, which we've learned that the pharmacology of these medications may actually associate with improved outcomes, such as maintaining appropriately elevated or good levels of a drug concentration is critically important to maintaining the efficacy of that drug. And that for at least some of the medications where we can measure drug concentrations, we've seen better outcomes when those drug concentrations are tailored in an individual personalized level to match dosing to the individual patient. So for example, with infliximab, where there's probably the greatest body of evidence, assessment of a trough level and being able to tailor that that drug dose to that patient's trough level to keep it high enough is now, I would argue, essentially standard in many places as far as how we would approach the optimization of therapy. Other biologics may have less robust evidence, and in general, ulcerative colitis probably has less robust evidence than in Crohn's disease, but we are certainly learning that therapeutic drug monitoring using this approach to optimize therapy is one strategy to personalize treatment towards improving outcomes. Another critically important new paradigm of treatment that has been incorporated and we continue to learn about is what we call a treat-to-target approach. A treat-to-target approach is where we understand and set goals and targets with the patient at the time of therapeutic selection, at the time of starting a new drug. What is our goal? What is the target of therapy? And how are we going to assess that target? When are we going to assess that target? And then what are we going to do? What's our plan if the target has not been reached? So when starting a new treatment with ulcerative colitis, our latest guidelines and recommendations from our international panel suggest that we start a new treatment. 6 months later, roughly, we would reassess with a colonoscopy and see, have we achieved the target? Has the patient achieved mucosal healing or significant mucosal improvement in terms of the inflammation there? If yes, great, we've hit the target, we maintain, and we continue to monitor in a maintenance mode. However, if the target has not been reached, at that point, a therapeutic change probably should be made or at least discussed with the patient. Is it optimization of the dose of the drug as we discussed earlier? Is it perhaps the addition of a second drug, or is it moving on and switching to a completely new therapeutic mechanism of action or a new drug? And this approach, this treat-to-target approach, now has accumulating evidence, certainly in Crohn's disease and hopefully soon in ulcerative colitis, that will provide the evidence basis for it. But what we've learned in Crohn's disease, as well as many other areas of medicine, is that using this treat-to-target proactive approach in a personalized way with patients associates with improved outcomes over time.
Thank you for sharing your clinical expertise, Dr. Malmed. Now on to our final interview. Professor Feagan discusses the primary considerations for the development of new therapies for the treatment of moderate to severe ulcerative colitis and the emerging drug classes or therapeutic targets showing greatest potential. He shares his expert insight on how the changing treatment landscape may impact clinical practice.
Well, one of the biggest issues with regard to new therapies in ulcerative colitis is the efficacy ceiling, in that we have drugs with multiple different mechanisms of action, but they're all 10 to 25% better than placebo in the short term for inducing remission. So efficacy is a huge issue. Secondly, safety. We've made tremendous progress in this regard. We have classes of drugs which are much safer, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, likely the anti-P19s, S1P1s, but this is really important to patients. And then finally, convenience to therapy is a critical issue. Patients prefer oral medications for their convenience, and healthcare systems prefer oral medications as well because of constraints on infusion systems and resources needed to train patients to give parenteral drugs. There are multiple new targets under consideration. We have new JAK inhibitors with filgotinib and upacitinib. We have anti-P19s with guselkumab and risankizumab and mirankizumab. And we have the S1P1s as novel lymphocyte trafficking inhibitors. So there are really a large number of opportunities currently underway. The JAK inhibitors have been very valuable drugs for the treatment of ulcerative colitis. They are broad-spectrum immunosuppressives. And so it's really a question of getting an optimal dose where you minimize immune suppression but achieve efficacy. And tofacitinib, when it became available, has been a very important drug for treating patients who have failed first-line biologic therapy and has an acceptable therapeutic index. However, there's been considerable controversy about this agent in rheumatoid arthritis and a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, and rulings by the FDA regarding black box warnings have lessened enthusiasm for the class. That's unfortunate in my view. Upacitinib is the latest agent, and along with filgotinib. And these drugs have clear-cut efficacy and I believe are appropriate to treat patients as first-line agents in selected patients. And that's a view that really goes against the opinion of the FDA acknowledged. Well, the S1P1 receptor modulators are an interesting class of drugs in that if you think about our success with vedolizumab as an inhibitor of the egress of white blood cells, lymphocytes, into the tissue, then there should be a parallel mechanism to get lymphocytes out of the tissue. And really, that's what this class does. They really modulate the expression of receptors that recognize S1P, sphingosine 1-phosphate, on lymphocyte, or that regulate the expression of a receptor that recognizes the S1P1 residues on lymphatic endothelial cells and controls trafficking. So the original member of this class, fingolimod, had a lot of toxicity associated with it. It was approved for MS and was a breakthrough drug there. The newer generation's drugs, ozanimod and etrasimod, have become more selective for S1P1 isotype 1 and 5. And are safer. And we have now have ozanimod being registered for therapy of ulcerative colitis in both Europe and the United States on the basis of large phase 3 study. And etrasimod has shown a very strong signal in phase 2 studies and is now in phase 3 development. Well, predictions are hard, especially about the future, but I'd venture to say that there is going to be increasing emphasis on oral therapies. We have safer drugs. If we can translate the safety of vedolizumab, ustekinumab, the anti-P19s into oral agents that are safe, then I think that sets the stage for a process that has been successful in other applications, notably hepatitis C and hepatitis B therapy, where we combine safe and effective oral therapies and get transformational efficacy. And that really is the solution to the problem. I started the talk by highlighting that current therapies have an efficacy ceiling. So this is a potential solution.
Thank you for sharing your expert insights, Professor Feagan. Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on ulcerative colitis and inflammatory bowel disease at www.touchimmunology.com.